The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning California time space show program. I'm your host, and we have a great human Mars-oriented program for you today. So let me get us through the announcements so we can start talking with our guest. Our toll-free number, which is also the preferred way of communicating with our guest on the live show, is 1-866-687-7223. And then you can email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also post a comment, and I'll get it as soon as you post it, on our blog. And to do that, you go to our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right, and you'll see the upcoming show menu. And this is the first program listed, so click on that program. It opens up our blog and archive page. Scroll to the bottom as you would if you wanted to make a blog comment, and ask your question or post your comment, and I will work it into our discussion as soon as I get it, which is almost instantly. So again, the preferred way is our phone number, 1-866-687-7223. And then email after that, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. If you're outside the U.S. and you want to give us a call, first of all, your country needs to allow toll-free calling to the United States. But this is an MCI toll-free number. So you would call your operator in your country and ask for the MCI operator and then tell her you're connecting to this number, and it's an area code 707 number, despite the fact that it's a toll-free number, and give them the toll-free number. And they should be able to connect you. Otherwise, you can email me, and I'll give you the direct 707 number where you can just direct dial the number, but it won't be toll-free for you. So we do hope you can give us a call or send us emails and participate in today's program. A couple of other real quick announcements. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, so you are free to download our shows and share them, though it is a lot simpler to just send people the URL for the posted show. There's a couple of rules about that. So one is you don't do anything commercial with our program, and number two, don't edit or cut or clip anything from them and post them on websites, including your own, and above all, including YouTube. And if you have any questions about that, don't hesitate to email me and ask me. And then also written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And our full copyright statement is at the bottom of all of our website pages, including our 501c3 nonprofit page, onegiantleapfoundation.org. So again, I'm happy to respond to your questions and your needs. So if you do have questions or issues, go ahead and send me an email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then on the website, there is a website newsletter center right on our homepage, and that is updated after the Sunday Space Show program. So make sure as you're looking at it that you scroll further down and you'll see all of the programs we have planned for the coming future. And if you would like to suggest a guest to us, please do so. If you have their electronic information, such as email, that is really helpful too, as well as the reason why you think this person would be a good space show guest. And everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website or rapidly download the programs. There is a store for space show memorabilia, and logoware, and that is in the upper left menu under support. You'll see our Cafe Press store. And you'll also in that upper left menu find a listen live button. This tells you how to listen to live shows, how to listen to compressed MP3 archive shows on our website, and how to listen to our podcasts, including those on Alexa. And the TuneIn player used by Alexa is embedded into our website for those of you who want to use that format. And if you have any questions or if you have any difficulties with your platform, whatever one you're using, please email me. I'll do my best to give you a hand and to help you. Also on our homepage, probably the most important part, is supporting the Space Show. And you'll see a whole area, including a big Amazon link and other material and information for supporting us. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And if you pay federal U.S. taxes, you get a deduction for your gift to us. And if you're a California taxpayer, then you also get a tax deduction, as we're a public benefit corporation in California. And you can get more information if you email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, or you go to our nonprofit website, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And your support keeps us on the air, and I'm not exaggerating or going into high drama on that. So if you like our programming and what we do, please step forward and support us, and we thank you very much for that. Now, the Amazon button, you may wonder why they're really big on our homepage. They have two fabulous programs for working with nonprofits and supporting them via a percentage of your purchase price being donated to the nonprofit. So if you click on that link, you'll go to our One Giant Leap Foundation Amazon page, which explains our One Giant Leap Amazon portal. And then the other program they have is a cloned website for nonprofits called Smile. And on Smile, everything you buy gets a percentage sent to the nonprofit. On the other one, only Amazon itself donates a piece of the action to the nonprofit. If you're using their third-party used book sellers, for example, or third-party sellers, they don't usually participate in that program, but it may depend upon the third party. So check out Amazon, and if you have any questions, don't hesitate to let me hear from you. One more quick announcement before we go into today's show. And since we're going to be largely talking about getting humans to Mars, I think it's only appropriate that the Space Show and its listeners offer our friend Dr. Bob Zubrin a hearty congratulations. He got married today, and his bride's name is Hope. That seems appropriate. And I don't know much about them, about her. I know Bob real well. I look forward to meeting her at the Mars Society Conference in Pasadena in August. But congratulations to Bob and Hope for their marriage from all of the Space Show family. And he tweeted that, so that's how come I know about it. So that brings me to today's program and today's, well, one more thing. This is a full-length program, listeners, so we're doing the sponsor messages today. And we have a revision to a sponsor messages because Orbital ATK is no longer. So now our sponsor messages from what used to be Orbital ATK says, Northrop Grumman is a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions to government and commercial customers worldwide, offering an extraordinary portfolio of capabilities and technology for applications from undersea to outer space and into cyberspace. As Northrop Grumman has completed the merger with Orbital ATK, and we're glad to be working now with Northrop Grumman. And then there is also the National Space Society, and everybody knows who they are and the fabulous work they do, and they're at Astra Magazine. Check them out at NSS.org. Very big on settlement for those of you that are also really pushing for space settlement. They have a whole space settlement section on their website. The Space Development Network is our sponsor, And they are an online organization and want advocates to join with them to advance a plan for space development. And they're looking for people with a wide variety of interest and skills. It's a free network to join. And again, you can get all the information you need to get at spacedevelopment, one word, .org. And the Space Foundation is our sponsor, and they put on these great symposiums every year. The 34th symposium was just completed in April. The symposium website is spacesymposium.org. You will find many of the 34th symposium talks and panels and comments already posted online. So they are at spacefoundation.org, and you can also access the symposium information at spacesymposium.org. And now I get to introduce our terrific guest for today, and I'm really happy to bring to everyone, myself included, John Connolly, who is currently the lead for NASA's Human Mars Study Team at Johnson. And he provides expert analysis of the human Mars architectural options to inform NASA decisions on human Mars missions. His team represents the agency's long-term architectural perspective in coordination and support of technology investment and development activities for NASA's human spaceflight, robotic space mission, and space tech organizations. His full bio is on our website, so you should check it out. We're going to talk with him, but I do want to point out he had a great panel and participation on this subject at the recent Human to Mars conference by Explore Mars Incorporated. That is online if you want to hear it. And then, in addition, he has done several FISO talks, including one with Harley Thrompson, and that you can get at the FISO website, too, about some of the topics we're going to be talking to John about today. So welcome to the Space Show, and it's great to talk to you, John. And tell us, you know, what NASA is doing to get us to Mars, and when, and will it be in my lifetime? I just turned 72.
Well, thank you, David, for inviting me, and good morning and good afternoon for the folks a little further east. You know, Mars has always been the ultimate target for us ever since we walked on the moon. And many of us who were kids, you know, watching the moon missions, you know, thought, hey, we better get to NASA as soon as we can so that we can, you know, start working on the Mars part of this exploration thing. And I know that's what turned me on back then, the whole idea of exploring deeper and deeper into space. And you know, it hasn't quite worked out as quickly as we wanted, but there is progress being made, and it kind of comes in 4 or 8 year chunks, and every so often we make some good forward progress, and then maybe there's a little lull, and we pick up again. So the good news, I think, is that NASA, ever since Apollo, has had some group of people that have been looking at how we get humans to Mars. And the plans evolve as technology changes, as sort of the political winds change, but we always have a plan. And so currently the Mars study team that we have we always have in our back pocket the best plan on how we would get to Mars if we were given the go ahead right now. And I think that well, we'll get into this, but you've probably heard talk about things like the Deep Space Gateway, or the Gateway as it's called now, as being a transportation node around the moon, and that actually does figure into getting us to Mars. So I think the recent focus on the moon is going to be good for space exploration in general. Because I think it is the first step getting us to Mars. So I think there's a lot of good things going on, and I hope to discuss that over the next 90 minutes.
So I've done several shows with people who have dissected the NASA budget when it comes out, and you know, in February and all of this. And one of the things that seems to be a universal among budget analysts is that NASA is significantly underfunded for the promises and the projects and their rhetoric and what they want to do. And this affects getting back to the moon and causes serious delay, and likely will also be causing delays for going to Mars too. So how bad is or how big a problem is the underfunding issue for the comprehensive NASA agenda?
Well, I don't think NASA being underfunded is anything new. I think NASA generally is always given more challenges than there are resources to meet. And one of the things that we've been really good at is, you know, is trying to do as much with the public funds as we can. Now, it's true that if you only have a, you know, flat budget or a budget that's adjusted for inflation, that there's only so much you'll be able to accomplish. And a lot of people ask, how can we do a return to the moon at the same time we're planning for Mars? Well, if it was all NASA money doing that, the answer would probably be you can't really do all that. I think what's changed over the last 5 or 10 years is that there are new players. We know that there's interest from the international community about partnering in exploring space again, stepping off beyond the International Space Station and using that experience as a way to partner with different countries to do some of these bold things. And then, of course, there's the commercial world, and that's the real new player in town. And we're very fortunate that you know, we're in an era now where individual companies in our country have the ability to do some of these big things, like launch big payloads or launch people into space, things that only nation states had been able to do in the past. So I think when you look at budgets, you have to look at the entirety of all the resources available to you, not just what's in the NASA budget.
Okay, and you have a phone call early in the show, so somebody is eagerly waiting to talk to you. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, it's Tupper from Maryland.
Nice to talk to you, Tupper.
Sure. I was asked, John, in the architecture work that you've done getting humans to and from Mars, how do cyclers figure into the trade space? When do they work out advantageously versus not having cyclers?
All right. Well, thanks for the question, Tupper. Most of the folks maybe who listen to this show know that cyclers are a particular type of transportation system that's been advocated by Buzz Aldrin for many years, and we've worked with Buzz for decades on the cycler concept. Just let me describe it so people know what it is. A cycler, in terms of a human Mars mission, think of it as a train that's on a kind of a permanent track that's going between Earth orbit and Mars orbit. And in order to get to Mars, you would hop on the train, you would leave Earth, hop on the train as it comes by Earth, and then as it goes by Mars, you would hop off the train. And then there's another train that takes you from Mars back to Earth at some point in the future. And you have these two constant cycling vehicles. So I think it's a really interesting idea. I think it's probably what I would term second or third generation type space transportation. A lot of what NASA does right now is, you know, just trying to do the Lewis and Clark kind of work. You know, how do we get the first people there? How do we transport them there, you know, within the capabilities we have? I think once you have maybe more of an infrastructure developed there and there's more of a cadence of regular missions going to and from Mars, things like cyclers come more into play. You know, it's a lot like a regularly scheduled train service, except with the cycler, you actually have to jump up to hyperbolic speed to jump on the cycler, and then, of course, you have to slow down when you get to your other to your destination. So it's a little more complex than just hanging around at the train station. But I think there is something there, but I don't think it really has it really doesn't factor into these very early missions that we're talking about. I think it comes in the second or the third generation of missions when Mars is a regular place that lots of people visit, and you need to get, you need to have what amounts to regularly scheduled service going between the Earth and Mars.
And I would also think, John, if you're throwing away your Earth to Mars and Mars to Earth transportation at every mission, you can only afford to do that for a little while. Eventually, you're going to want to reuse the train, which can be more comfortable than the one-way trip, one use.
Well, that's right, and I think what we're seeing is reusability is happening in more and more places now. It's not just in launch vehicle first stages. But yeah, that's the key to economics in space travel is reuse. And, the fact that you have this train moving between Earth and Mars is part of the solution to that. Now, you still have to accelerate up to that, so there's still some kind of crew vehicle that has to accelerate you from Earth and get to that hyperbolic intercept. And then you need another vehicle once you get to Mars to slow you down. So it may not exactly, even with cyclers, be a 100% reusable architecture, but you're right, that interplanetary transit vehicle does become kind of a reusable part.
Thanks for your answer, John.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tupper.
Thank you for your call. Listeners, and that opens up our toll-free number. If you would like to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. He kind of jumped us ahead a little bit, so let's take a step or two back. And you mentioned, that the cycler's probably not going to be great for the initial phases. How do you actually see the genesis stage or the beginning of the initial stage? How do we initially get humans to Mars?
Okay. Well, you mentioned early in the introduction that we did a little bit of work at the Humans to Mars conference describing a few different points along a continuum of different types of human Mars missions. And that continuum kind of starts with, I guess, what I would call Apollo-esque kind of missions on the far left side of the continuum, and then progresses on to missions that are more like establishing some of the early bases in the Antarctic, and then eventually on the far right end of the continuum you have something that is on the order of going towards human permanent human habitation. So what we're looking about now is kind of on the far left side of that continuum. So it's probably not Apollo-style short sorties because the physics of getting to Mars is much different. The NASA reference missions that have been out for a couple decades typically favor conjunction class missions, which are what most people would call long stay surface missions. So even the initial missions where we're sending people out to Mars, we envision those being long-stay missions where you're in the Mars sphere of influence for something on the order of a year or a year and a half, depending on your propulsion system. But that first step is still sort of very Apollo-like because, you're shaking down all the spacecraft and all the equipment that gets you there. So in some ways it's Apollo-like. In some ways it's very much past Apollo. In fact, if you think of going to Mars versus going to the Moon, it's literally three orders of magnitude further away in terms of your trip distance. And while Mars isn't probably three orders of magnitude harder to do than the Moon, it's up there. It's a lot harder to do than going to the Moon. And the biggest challenge is usually propulsion, because propulsion tends to have it tends to be the one thing you have to decide on that has the most interconnections with everything else in the design of the mission. So if you choose a propulsion system that's very efficient, but perhaps like an electric propulsion system, that will it'll get you to Mars. It'll take a lot longer to get to Mars, and that'll affect a lot about how you design your in-space systems and limit the amount of time you're there. If you use an impulsive system like a chemical rocket or a nuclear thermal rocket, you'll get to Mars faster, but you have the development of that type of system and the inefficiencies of a lower ISP. So right now, the way we're thinking about that first mission, the initial mission, is that it starts at the gateway. Okay, we're going to have this brand new small orbital platform orbiting the moon, and it turns out that it's maybe not in the perfect orbit to depart for Mars, but it's pretty close, because what you want to do is you want to get as far up into the gravity well away from Earth as possible. So that it has the right idea there. So you start from the gateway or an associated orbit. You make a burn. You depart for Mars. Your crew is in a transit vehicle. Right now we're thinking that transit vehicle borrows the best of a couple different propulsion systems. You use an impulsive system to give you the kick where you need to get in and out of orbits, for example, as you arrive at Mars and as you depart. You combine that with an electric propulsion system that's very efficient, that can shape your orbit in transit and accelerate your arrivals and departures. So you have the crew and you have this hybrid propulsion system. Ahead of the crew, you've already sent, using that same propulsion system, a number of landers. And some of them go directly to the surface and pre-position some of the things you'll need, and one stays in orbit, and that's the lander that'll land the crew. And so when the crew arrives at Mars, 8 or 10 months later, depending on which opportunity it is, you transfer from the transit vehicle to the lander. The lander goes down to the surface. You already have some habitation on the surface. You have space power. You have pressurized rovers. You have the fundamental things you need to do exploration on Mars. And the first crew does their surface mission. And, of course, the first humans land on Mars. Someone gets to be the first person and say something that goes into the history books. At the end of the surface mission, which could be a year or maybe a little longer, you come back to Mars orbit. Your transit vehicle is waiting for you. The crew gets into the transit vehicle, and they do that impulsive kick to get them out of Mars orbit, and then the SEP guides them the rest of the way back to Earth and back to the gateway. So that first mission is a little bit Apollo style in that, it's kind of this fundamental Lewis and Clark kind of mission, but one of the things it does is it starts leaving behind infrastructure that future missions can build upon. So there are things like small nuclear power sources that we leave on the surface. There are habitation elements. There are pressurized rovers. And then the subsequent missions that land after that get to build on that infrastructure that the first mission has taken there.
So when you're talking about the gateway, you're talking about LOPG, correct?
Yes, LOPG is, I don't think we use that term very much internal to NASA. Everybody just calls it Gateway.
So it is controversial, especially with the space show audience. There are either those that hate it with a passion or those that, I don't say they love it, but they're willing to tolerate it. Mm-hmm. So from your perspective and what I'm hearing, the Gateway, LOPG is such a crappy name, we'll just call it the Gateway too. From your perspective, the Gateway is not only beneficial for going to Mars, but essential. Am I hearing that right?
Well, you could go to Mars without it, but one of the fundamental things that we've learned from studying Mars missions over the years is that you need a place to aggregate the pieces of a Mars mission before you depart Earth. And whether this is a low Earth orbit or a high Earth orbit, the fact that you have this gateway element there does benefit you because it does give you that aggregation point. Because we simply don't have a giant launch vehicle where we could launch a Mars-bound spacecraft all in one piece like we did in Apollo. So there's going to have to be multiple launches of elements that you have to put together somewhere. And it's not in a perfect orbit, but it's in a pretty good orbit for doing that.
So as I understand it then, and this is why a lot of people don't like the Gateway, is that you come from Earth with your materials and supplies and your crew, and you go to the Gateway, and you're not really going to the surface of the moon, and people want to actually return to the surface of the moon. But the voyage onto Mars doesn't take off from the surface of the moon with the lower gravity. It would actually depart from the Gateway. Is that correct?
That is correct. And so the Gateway, you know, I hate to keep using the train analogy, but the Gateway is a little bit like the train station. You know, you go to the Gateway, and from there you can depart down to the surface of the moon relatively efficiently, or you can build up the infrastructure, the vehicles that will take you out to Mars. So it tends to be a transportation node, if you will.
Where are we today, in 2018, the year's half over, with our TRLs for this initial Mars mission?
Well, it's a little bit of a mixed bag. So the I described the sort of the initial Lewis and Clark style Mars mission. I'd say for some of the pieces, the TRLs are increasing rapidly. We just had a test earlier this year of the small nuclear power system. It's a little reactor called Kilopower that can produce 10 kilowatts of power and packages very nicely. And so that one, I'd say the TRL is well up there. It hasn't been proven in space yet, but we've basically tested it exactly as it would be operated here on Earth. The propulsion systems that I noted earlier are kind of one of the key decisions you have to make to get you to Mars. The key one is, the key two are a chemical system, and that could be right now. We're looking at LOX methane, although there are other options. I'd say we're probably not as far along on the methane propulsion because that's not an engine type that NASA has really used before. On the solar electric propulsion, we are much further along. There have been SEP thrusters tested at NASA Glenn for years and years and years, and we have lots of runtime on those. And all we need to do now is scale those up to the size that we need for a Mars vehicle. So propulsion-wise, I think we're good. In terms of the human systems, we have this great laboratory called the International Space Station. And I think we're going to make a lot of progress over the coming years in things like life support systems and learning how to keep systems alive for long periods of time. One of the big differences, again, between a Mars mission and any other mission we've ever flown before is that as soon as you leave the sphere of influence of the Earth, Sir Isaac Newton is in control. And you can't simply just turn around and come back in case something breaks. And so we're going to have to have very long, very reliable systems, maintainable systems. We're going to have to know how to fly without having resupplies from Earth coming up every couple months. So I'd say it's kind of a mixed bag right now. People ask me, could we go to Mars today if we were suddenly just given the okay and given the resources? And the answer is, yeah, we probably could. It wouldn't be an elegant mission, and it would probably be high risk, but I think we could do it. I think with a little bit more technology advancement, we can do it a lot more elegantly.
Jack is in Tucson. He's our first email question, and he says, listening to your plans for the NASA version of the initial trip, certainly when we hear Mr. Musk talk about the SpaceX version, with his VFR of an initial trip to Mars is pretty different. Do you, with your team, pay attention to how SpaceX intends to get to Mars, or what can you say about it? Because it's almost as if there's two rival strategies and maybe two rival programs for getting humans to Mars.
Well, of course, we pay attention to the SpaceX folks and to the other commercial companies out there that have ideas about how to get to Mars. In fact, we have a lot of friends at SpaceX and at the other places. One of the great things about SpaceX is that Elon could be visionary. And it's great for the space business in general. He gets people excited, and he makes these large pronouncements, and he puts his money behind it. So it's not just talk to him. I think if you do look at the SpaceX Mars architecture versus the NASA architecture, it's obviously different. You know, it's a BFR, and then the big spacecraft that takes lots of people to Mars at a time. What it is a transportation architecture. It doesn't really have a lot of the other pieces that NASA tends to worry about, like the surface habitats and the surface power systems and all that. I think if you look at a SpaceX presentation, you see that notionally shown. But SpaceX is in the space transportation business, and so they want to get large things to Mars, large amounts of people to Mars. I think that if you take SpaceX's space transportation capabilities, if those were to come online, and you take some of the other elements that NASA thinks more about, and you combine them, I think there are some joint public-private architectures there that are very, very intriguing. And that's why we tend to have these kind of meetings like the Affording Mars meeting, where we invite the folks like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and others to come with their ideas. Just because I told you what the current NASA ideas are, doesn't mean that we're not in contact with the folks like SpaceX, because we are. And we're always looking for how you can build a mission using the best of all the capabilities that we have.
The SpaceX plan, as I understand it, uses this huge rocket, the BFR, and goes to Mars but doesn't make use of the Gateway. Would the Gateway be available to a commercial user on its own, not through a public-private partnership, but to a commercial user as a standalone commercial user? Or do you not know the answer to that?
Well, I don't really know the answer to that, but I think the general trajectory that NASA is on encourages commercial users and public-private partnerships all along. So if there was a commercial user who wanted to use Gateway, I'm sure NASA would entertain talking with those folks.
I have another email from Bjorn, who is in Sweden. And he says, I wonder why the idea of first going to the two moons of Mars isn't more popular. They are scientifically hugely interesting in themselves and might have the most primordial material of old wet Mars as ejecta preserved in a vacuum. They would give experience in handling asteroids. They will be visited sooner or later anyway, and they are easier to begin with. Such a mission would spend about 33 months in microgravity, so simulating gravity by rotation is required. That is, however, useful for making the following trips to Mars comfortable. Otherwise, it would be much like the familiar routines on the ISS. So how about the two moons of Mars?
Well, also a good question. It turns out, actually, getting to Phobos and Deimos, the moons of Mars, is not all that simple. And it's purely a matter of physics. The moons of Mars, much like our moon, orbits in the ecliptic plane, in Mars's equatorial plane. And as you approach Mars from Earth, you're going to arrive at an angle to that plane. And that's just the basic planetary physics of flying around in space. And that means in order to get from whatever initial orbit you go into around Mars, which will be inclined, down to an orbit where you can even get to Phobos and Deimos will require a fairly large plane change. And at least for the initial missions we're talking about, you know, plane changes take either a lot of fuel or a lot of time and a little fuel. And so we don't see us taking that kind of delta V with us to do the plane change to get down into Phobos and Deimos, into an equatorial orbit. And then, of course, you have to change your plane again to get into the right departure angle. And so you actually kind of pay the penalty twice. Now, let's say that you did decide that you're going to do that, though, and you get into an equatorial kind of orbit with the Phobos and Deimos. You have to now bring with you some other types of exploration vehicles or exploration equipment that you could use to explore them with. So you wouldn't need landers like the kind that take you all the way down to the surface of Mars, but you would need some sort of excursion vehicle that would take you from your interplanetary vehicle down to the down to Phobos or Deimos. So it's not quite as hardware intensive as a landed mission to the Martian surface, but it is actually more difficult than you would think it would be to do a mission. You know, you would think that, oh, you just go into orbit around Mars and there's Phobos and Deimos, you go visit them. It's actually not that easy. We did look at a Phobos and Deimos mission as a possible precursor to a human landed mission. And, you know, those plane changes that you have to do to get in and out of Mars equatorial orbit just eat your lunch.
Okay, and a couple of years ago, I did an interview with a couple of chaps from Lockheed, and at the time, I forget what it was called, Mars Base Camp or something like that, Mars Orbiter, sort of a gateway around Mars, was their solution for initially going to Mars, where you would go to this orbiting platform and then use landers to make excursions down to the surface. Is that idea part of any of your planning, or have you moved on from that?
So the Mars Base Camp is still a valid idea that's out there that the Lockheed guys talk about. If you think about it, the Mars Base Camp is the equivalent of the Lunar Gateway that NASA's talking about now. It's a node in orbit around Mars. It's your safe haven. It's your transportation node. It's where you would arrive at, and that's where the landers would depart from to go to the surface. So it has a lot of the same characteristics as the gateway. I think that the key features about Mars Base Camp from the Lockheed concept is that they set it up specifically to provide you with a lot of different contingency scenarios in case things happen. So there's two landers and two propulsion vehicles and two different habitat volumes and things like that. So that's all good. I think if you looked at the mass of that, it would be a fairly massive vehicle. The initial missions that NASA's looking at aren't quite that massive. We use mass as sort of a proxy for cost in many ways, since so much of the cost of a human Mars mission is just the cost of pushing mass, you know, from the surface of Earth into space. You know, as you're designing missions, mass kind of becomes your first proxy. And if you could design a lighter mission, that's better than a heavy mission. So I think I think there's a lot of good ideas out there, and Basecamp is a good idea. It gives you lots of capabilities maybe that the NASA baseline doesn't give you, but it's gonna cost you in terms of mass. So every capability you buy, you have to pay for.
Brenda's in Seattle, and says, would it be cost-effective, and do you believe there's any serious chance of this happening to influence your initial or, let's say, early missions to Mars? And here I'm talking about actually having advanced nuclear propulsion to get to Mars.
Well, so nuclear propulsion comes in two flavors. The one that most people think of is nuclear thermal propulsion, where you're using the heat of a nuclear reactor and you're pushing some fluid through it, rapidly expanding that fluid and pushing it out the the nozzle. So we refer to that as nuclear thermal propulsion. The other type of nuclear propulsion is where you use a nuclear reactor to produce electricity, and then you use that electricity for electric propulsion. And by doing that, you can produce large amounts of electricity for either electric propulsion or any of the electrodynamic kind of systems, like Vasimir, for example. Most of the work that we've done recently has revolved around nuclear thermal propulsion. And in fact, that's been kind of the NASA baseline for a while until recently, until we really started looking at these hybrid systems. But nuclear thermal is still in play. You know, it's still an option. The great thing about it is very efficient, and it gives you that high thrust kick that you need. So it in many ways it's kind of the best of both systems. You get high ISP and high thrust out of it. The one thing you have to bite off, though, is it's nuclear thermal propulsion, and you are putting reactors in space, and they're fairly high power reactors, and we tried those in the 60s and got a lot of good work out of the NERVA program, but we'd have to restart that, and it would probably be a longer development for a nuclear thermal rocket engine than it would be for a regular chemical engine.
But over time, would it serve better than chemical engines once you got over the hurdle of the R&D and all the political protests that would, you know, come about and all of that? Would it be a better way to go for the future?
Well, it depends. I'm going to back us up a little bit.
Okay.
A lot of the things we talk about when we are talking about human missions all comes down to minimizing mass. As I said before, mass is our proxy for cost, and that's because launch vehicles currently cost something on the order of $10,000 a kilogram to launch things into Earth orbit. That's why systems like solar electric propulsion and nuclear thermal propulsion are so intriguing, because they're lower mass solutions to getting people to Mars. If there were if the economics changed suddenly, where the cost of launch came down by a factor of 10, let's say, all of a sudden, a lot of the high technologies that we'd be looking at for space propulsion might actually fall by the wayside, because if it were not as costly to launch mass into Earth orbit, simple chemical systems might win out. And so, so the answer to is one system better than another kind of depends on the economics of launch. You know, right now, a lot of the technology work NASA does is all about minimizing mass. That's why we're using ISRU. That's why we're, trying to come up with very lightweight composites and lightweight structures. If it was simple to throw mass into space, or it didn't cost much to do so, the solutions would be a lot different.
We're at the break time, but I have two questions that came in, and I think you can put them to rest quickly. So the first one is Jennifer in Denver, and Jennifer says, specifically looking at life support and the need to be Earth independent or to have a closed loop life support system for going to Mars, where are we at on a TRL for that?
So that's one of the key technologies that we need to get us to Mars. Being Earth independent, I think, is correct. Being entirely closed loop may not be absolutely necessary, because once we get to Mars, there's a nice carbon dioxide atmosphere that's very easy to crack the oxygen out of. So on the water side right now, yeah, we have to close the loop of that pretty well until we figure out how to extract water from the Martian environment. On the air side, we probably don't have to be quite as closed loop as we thought we had to. So I'd say TRL-wise, I couldn't quote exact TRL numbers for you, but again, the great thing about having the ISS flying is that the life support systems that we're going to use on transit to Mars and on the surface to Mars are fundamentally the same as many that we're using in space right now. So I'd say for a number of the systems that we have for water recycling and air recycling, we're at TRL 9, you know, demonstrated in space and fully operating on the International Space Station. There's others, improvements to what we have on the station that are probably on their way between maybe TRL 6 and, you know, once we get them in space and actually start using them, they'll start inching up to the higher TRL numbers.
So the lowest we're at is probably around a 6 or so?
I imagine there might be some technologies that are lower than that, but I'd say most of the life support technologies that we contemplate using for Mars are either demonstrated on ISS or in the mid-TRL range right now.
Listeners, I had an email to ask from Baker in Boston, and it has mysteriously disappeared from Outlook. So, Baker, if you're still listening to the show, we're going to take a break. Please resend your email. I can't find it. It's not in spam or delete. It's just gone. Not surprising with Outlook, but hopefully you're still listening and you can still send it. And listeners, we're going to take a pause now for a couple of minutes. We are a little bit beyond the halfway point, and we will be back with our guest and more about humans to Mars and a little bit about where the moon actually fits in on this, too. So don't go anyplace. In 3 minutes, we'll be back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Space Show program. Our guest, John Connolly, we're talking about humans to Mars. And we do want to thank our second segment sponsors, the Integrated Space Plan, which is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how the technologies and destinations build upon one another and explore the hundreds of individual elements in more detail. And their website is thespaceplan.com. You can buy your own version of the full color poster, and it comes in two different types. So very impressive to have, and you know, suitable for hanging on the wall. So check it out, thespaceplan.com. The AIAA is our sponsor, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, 30,000 or so individual members, 88 countries represented, about 100 corporate members, and these people are all shaping the future of aerospace every day, and they advance aerospace science and technology as well. 5 events during the year, or conferences, or forums as they like to be called, and get all the information at AIAA.org. And then Celestis is our sponsor, and they are the only provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services in the world. And they have a robust 2018 manifest, and you can find them all listed on the schedule. They include going to the moon, launching from Vandenberg, and polar and Falcon Heavy launches. And you can now add your own DNA to a mission. So with your loved one's ashes or DNA, you can include your own DNA and join yourself with your loved one in the space flight. So check them out at Celestis, CELESTIS.com. And remember, I am their customer with my dogs and my mom. And they're a terrific company to deal with, one of the best companies I've ever done business with. I know that's weird to say about a funeral company, but these guys are really first-rate and wonderful people. John Baker resent his email from Boston. To what extent do we really need to land and get a settlement or a habitat started on the moon to prepare us for humans to Mars?
All right. And so, John, thanks for the question. There's a couple of schools of thought here, and some of it is ruled by emotion rather than logic. So you have folks that say, well, you know, we've been to the moon, you know, we don't need to go back there, let's just go on to Mars. And then you have folks maybe who've thought a little bit more about it, and you know, it's been a long time since we've been to the moon, and Mars is a huge, huge step in technology and distance and capability. So my feeling is that we need to go back to the moon to relearn the art of exploration, and we need to do a whole lot of testing of the systems and the operations that will inform us on how to get to Mars. And we've been looking at that a lot recently because there's been this recent NASA focus at looking at the moon. And so we've actually looked at, well, you know, what are the pieces of just the transportation infrastructure to take you to and from the moon that have, you know, very logical feed-forward connections to Mars? And there turns out to be quite a few of those. Yeah, and then if you look at the surface things, you know, what are the things you could do on the surface of the moon that have, you know, no kidding, logical feed-forward connections to Mars? And there's quite a few of those as well. And then, of course, there's a lot of things in human health and performance and operations that have similar feed forwards. So I think the answer is, if you choose the things you do on the moon carefully, you can make the moon very, very useful as a way to reduce your risk of going to Mars. And that's the way we look at it.
So if you do that, and you've chosen carefully and correctly, and you go to Mars, do you abandon what you have learned and what you have created, that habitat or outpost on the moon? Is there a reason in your mind to stay on the moon?
Well, sure. I mean, the moon is a fantastic scientific destination unto itself. I think just because you're testing the things you need to test to go to Mars doesn't mean you abandon the moon. You know, we probably learned more about the moon, more about what we don't know about the moon since we left in 1972 than we found out about what we do know about it. So I think if you talk to the scientists, you know, they're loaded with questions about the moon, and you know, and they want to go not only explore the parts of the moon that maybe we've been to before, but explore some of the more exotic places like the poles and Aristarchus region, the South Pole Lake and Basin. The moon is really a great scientific location, so I don't think we should abandon the moon just because we're going to Mars. Now, how you do that fiscally is another question, and maybe this is where we start talking again about how you transfer ownership of things from government control to private control. You know, there's a lot of thought being put into that these days.
Our friend in Sweden, Bijan, gave you a follow-up to what he asked in the first segment. I had imagined some potential problems with going to the moons of Mars first, but the inclination was not one of them. Mars and its moons have an inclination of less than 2 degrees, the distance between the two moons only requires 4 kilometers a second of delta V. I still wonder why it's an unpopular idea.
Okay. Well, I mean, this gets into some of the nitty-gritties of orbital mechanics, but he is correct that the moons of Mars, you know, are very close to rotating in Mars' equatorial plane. The problem is that when you're arriving from the Earth, you're not arriving in the equatorial plane. The arrival asymptote is at an angle, and similarly, your departure from the moon back to Earth has to be at an angle to get you back there. And it's that angular difference, you know, north and south of equatorial, that causes the big plane changes. So that probably requires a blackboard and a probably 30 minutes of sit down in orbital mechanics. But that's kind of it in a nutshell.
So the 2 degrees is more significant than just seeing the number 2.
Well, it's not 2 degrees. I mean, the angle changes depending on which year you go. But if I recall, it could be as high as 30 degrees. So imagine you approach from Earth and you go into an orbit that's inclined 30 degrees to the equator. That means to get to Phobos at Deimos, you would have to do a 30-degree plane change to get down into equatorial orbit to get to those moons. And it's those kind of plane changes that are very expensive to do.
So the inclination is just part of the story, but not all of it.
It's a big part of the story, yes.
Okay. So I do want to bring up this survey that the Pew Institute, or whatever they call themselves, the Pew Foundation, did in Pew Research Center, and I know you've seen it. It's reported, listeners, in Space News, as well as other places. So there's large-scale support for NASA and the planetary missions and the science missions, but when they get into asking people about going to Mars, it's not so great. And then if they ask by political party, there's a difference in the political party. The human side of space travel doesn't seem to interest people, including younger people, nearly as much as the science and the planetary side. There seems to be strong support, much stronger support, for example, for NASA to be engaged in climate science study than for going to Mars or even going back to the moon. By the way, the moon scores worse than going to Mars scores. So does this influence NASA policy about human spaceflight at all, or is it wrong, or what are we to make of this?
Well, I'm sure NASA has taken note of this. The one thing that I read into this as I saw that article was, well, first of all, polling is an art, and so you have to ask, you have to know how to ask the right questions the right way. And in this particular question, they asked people to rank programs that already exist that NASA is doing, like keeping tabs on climate change, with programs that don't exist yet, like going to Mars or returning to the moon. And I think that skewed the results somewhat, because I think, you know, there'll always be support for programs that are currently ongoing, that are valuable, that you know the value of, versus programs that are kind of out there in the future. So if I was going to do that polling, I would kind of separate out the current NASA programs from the potential NASA programs, and kind of rank those ask people to rank those independently. I think it's a mixed bag, and I'm not sure what to make of the results exactly, other than people score programs that don't exist yet lower in priority than they score programs that do exist.
But it seems kind of strange that younger people don't care about going to Mars as much or to the moon. I think that's probably true just from my contact with people in general. But as I mentioned to you before the show started, Dr. Mary Lou Dittmar did a survey about this about 10 or 12 years ago. And we covered it extensively with her on several space show visits. And back then, millennials didn't exist, but there was still a younger segment. And they were really turned off about going to Mars. They could care less. And they didn't even have that as a goal. But they do, you know, like space exploration and space science and all of that. But they didn't even want to go to Mars themselves, and they didn't see it as an important aspect. So I think this sort of backs up what Mary Lou did years and years and years ago. And I am not that surprised because of people that I meet out in the general public, and we could chalk that up to saying, well, they don't know very much. Or, you know, they only hear Elon Musk's name, they don't really know that much about him, or they may not know that he has Tesla or that he has SpaceX, but they might recognize those names maybe more than his name. So I'm a bit concerned. I don't know whether the concern is justified or not. Are we missing something in how we work with our younger generations in science and engineering and adventure? I mean, space does really well on sci-fi, right? I mean,
it does so well that people think we've been to Mars already.
Well, so does one congressman who thought we planted a flag on Mars. But so, you know, I don't understand why we, you know, the science fiction side does well, and things like the Expanse or whatever it's called. Everybody was cheering at ISDC when Bezos announced that they're going to carry it on Amazon and continue it, and on and on and on. There's all sorts of new TV programs that focus on space travel and humans and sci-fi. And then for the real thing, it's not very popular.
Well, I mean, that goes into the fact that doing real things in space is not quite as sexy as how we portray space in movies and on television. And I do like The Expanse, and I will point out in The Expanse, the Mars guys are kind of bad guys. But, you know, we make it look sexier, we make it look easier than it actually is in the media. And, you know, in fact, sending people to Mars is probably going to be the most difficult thing we've ever done as a species. It's a big deal. You know, sending real people to Mars and walking on Mars, becoming a multi-planet species is a evolutionary step. You know, it is a big deal, and maybe it's a shame that people, you know, see too much of this on television and they think we've done it already or that it's easy, because it's hard, and it is going to be a historical thing when we do it.
You have a note on this subject from Jerry in Dallas. And by the way, listeners, there's still time if many of you want to call in instead of email, 1-866-687-7223. So Jerry is in Dallas, and he said, I would imagine that probably an extremely high percentage of the space show audience, maybe way over 95%, support human spaceflight and wanting to return to either the moon or Mars or both. David has even had callers call in, and they want to settle Titan, and they want to, you know, look for life and go to Enceladus and other places as well. So his audience is probably more unique on this than the audience in general. But when I hear space reported in the general audiences, it's usually not done very accurately or done very well, and the reporters don't seem to know very much about the subject. I'm wondering if the group surveyed in this Pew poll is heavily influenced by general media types rather than specialized space media folks, the kind of people that come on David's show or speak at conferences or something of that nature. My hunch is if these people were exposed to real reporters that understood space, like Leonard David or Alan Boyle or many, many others, they might have a totally different opinion. I'm suspecting there's a lot of misinformation And because people are not really that informed on anything with space, yet they're reporting on it, they give out bad information, but even worse, they don't inspire people because they don't even know what they're talking about to inspire. I'm just wondering or curious if you have had very many experiences with general media types of interviews and how they compare to talking to people that really understand the issues and know space and know human space flight. I suspect that's where the gap originates.
Wow. Okay. Well, I thoroughly get where he's coming from. We, you know, oftentimes we give interviews to the media, and they are technical. You know, we try to boil things down to make it accessible. But a lot of these topics are very technical, and it's the media's job to even try to simplify that more for a more general audience. And sometimes, or maybe oftentimes, they don't quite get it right. An example just happened yesterday, by the way. There was a NASA news conference to announce some findings from some of the Mars missions that we have going on right now.
Right.
And one of them, I believe, one of the findings was that we found some complex organic molecules on Mars, benzene kind of molecules, although they're not benzene, but aromatic hydrocarbon type things. And and to scientists, that's a big deal because those kind of compounds are only formed, by certain processes. But you know, the media wants to be able to put that in a headline, and a lot of the media organizations, you know, want to make that leap of faith between this finding and NASA finding life. So NASA did not announce we found life on Mars yesterday. We announced that we found some clues of some chemistry that could possibly have indicated that could possibly be, you know, from life origins, or it could be from geologic origins. And the people did a very good job at the press conference laying that out. But if you look at the headlines today, most of them talk about, you know, NASA makes big announcement about possible life on Mars. And that actually wasn't the announcement we made at all. So I'm not sure what to do exactly about how the media takes data and turns it into the 30 second clips that we get every day. But we have to do a better job.
Well, do you think that might be a reason why people are not as interested in the human spaceflight side as we would like them to be?
Because the media doesn't get things right.
Yeah, because they're not getting good information. And so if they really think that NASA has found or is about to announce having found life on Mars, and then that doesn't happen, then their expectations go bust, and people tend to tune out what doesn't meet their expectations.
Now, I think the maybe the lack of interest in human spaceflight right now has to do with the fact that that there's only kind of small routine things going on in human spaceflight. I think in a couple years, when we fly the EM-1 mission that we're currently talking about, which is the first flight around the moon with crews in the Orion capsule and using the big SLS launch vehicle, I think the interest will go up again because now you have people, you know, going out into the great beyond and you know, taking little bits of risk. I don't think the public perceives there's much risk in space right now. I think they know in general there's a space station, there's people up there, and they're doing good science and all that, but they don't see that as being exploration. It's just a laboratory in space. I think the interest comes when you have people, pushing the envelope, and that's certainly a big part of why Apollo was so popular, because everybody can kind of imagine themselves as one of those astronauts out there, kind of hanging on the edge and taking risks and going further than anybody had gone before. So we haven't seen that for a while, though. I mean, the shuttle program closed down a while ago, and we haven't really seen its replacement yet. But I think once we do see that, I would expect an uptick in space exploration interest.
One of the topics that always comes up, especially when SpaceX and Elon Musk are talking about their rapid timeline, for example, to go to Mars, is planetary protection, and are humans going to be allowed to go to some of the more desirable places at Mars rather than to sort of go to the polar areas that are really cold and aren't as desirable. What are your thoughts? By the time we're ready to put humans on Mars, will planetary protection issues be resolved for getting humans to Mars? Will NASA itself have to go against those regulations and challenge and lobby? Well, they don't lobby, but challenge and try to educate and persuade to say we want to land humans here and not way over there in an irrelevant freezing place. How do you see planetary protection unfolding?
Well, planetary protection, for the most part, was created by NASA, so that's hard for us to go against our own rules. So in general, I think that by the time humans get to Mars, and let's say that's as early as 15 or 20 years from now, we'll understand a lot more about Mars and a lot more about planetary protection as it relates to humans than we do now. I think we'll have some samples back from Mars as part of the Mars sample return missions by then. And we'll have a good idea for, we'll have some real samples in hand to analyze, so we'll know what Mars is really like. That said, whenever you send humans to explore, it's going to be a little dirty around them. Humans, we tend to, for lack of a better term, off-gas a lot. I kind of see humans on any surface kind of like the Pigpen character from Charlie Brown, right? And that's kind of the way the planetary protection people think of astronauts on EVA, is having this big cloud of dust following us around. And that's not entirely untrue. EVA suits are going to leak. We're going to vent things overboard from the spacesuits, from the habitats. There'll be effluent from the landers and things like that. So I think there are real planetary protection concerns in terms of, how much of, these Earth, how much of these things we bring with us that naturally come with us as humans. We have talked about that. There was just a little meeting about that a couple months ago down here in Houston where we discussed that. And right now, I wouldn't say it's fair that humans are going to be relegated to some, far, cold end of Mars, and that's the only place you can explore. In fact, we're working with the Mars science community to identify exploration zones that are of high scientific interest, but maybe keep the human exploration somewhat separate from areas that are better explored by robots. So, for example, let's say you did find, some signs of some fragile life on Mars. We would probably want to send robotic missions there first before sending humans, so that we don't, complicate the science. So I don't think planetary protection is unsolvable. I think we'll learn a lot about it from sample return protocols. I think that once you get a set of human eyes and hands on Mars, the gains that you get from having the scientists there, you'll have to weigh against the negatives of actually having humans there and what they bring with them.
Interesting. So, not to lose hope that humans will probably come out of this okay, I guess.
Yes, humans will not be relegated to just sitting in their can on Mars and operating robots. Don't worry about that.
Now, of course, Mars has already been contaminated by Earth satellites and things that have crashed there and that have gone there that weren't fully sterilized. So it already is, to some degree, a human-contaminated planet, right?
Absolutely. Many of the early missions that were sent to Mars, especially by some of the other countries, weren't sterilized at all, probably. So, yeah, there are no doubt contaminants on Mars already.
Interesting. Are you at all concerned about the other direction for contamination, bringing a sample back to Earth? Are we going to have Andromeda strain back here on Earth?
Well, I only worry about it when people invoke the Andromeda strain book. You have to worry about that a little bit, right? It's one of those events that is very, very low probability, but very, very high, could have a very, very high negative effect. And so, this is one of those places where I think the Mars sample return mission really helps us, is on the contamination part of planetary protection, about bringing things back to Earth with us. And so, I think that will answer most of the questions we have about whether there's any bugs on Mars that may be of, that may be dangerous to us here on Earth.
I can just see the headlines now. Mars return engineers and scientists mysteriously die 3 months after sample comes back to Earth. That it wasn't Mars bugs. You can just see what they'll do with those headlines.
We've discussed things like, well, once the first humans go to Mars, you know, you're out there sampling, and there's no doubt going to be some interaction with the Mars atmosphere, the dust and things like that, and it's going to be impossible to keep everything pristine inside the spacecraft, and the crew is going to have to live with that Mars dust, a little bit of it anyway, all the way home. So you actually have a built-in experiment with the crew coming home for 6 or 8 or 10 months, having to live with this Martian material around them.
Helen is in Boston, and she says, are you personally satisfied with the humans to Mars timeline, or if you were the almighty czar of all of this, what would you be able to do to really speed up the timeline to get humans to Mars?
Well, the humans to Mars, if she's talking about humans to Mars timeline, being kind of the notional, let's get people out to Mars, or at least close, in the early 2030s, and then to the surface in maybe the mid 2030s. I am actually okay with that. I think that is that's an achievable timeline. I think that actually allows you to do some valuable things on the moon in the 2020s to get ready, and then to build the hardware that you need to get you out to Mars in the early 2030s. So that's not a rush program. That's not an Apollo type program, but I think that's a very reasonable timeline to accomplish things in.
So I don't know how old you are, but we're talking 15, maybe 20 years from now. So you and many others, this seems to be a trend in space, right? You work on projects that you're no longer around or employed in the project by the time it comes to fruition. Doesn't that frustrate you on its own?
Well, yes and no. So how old am I? I was 9 years old when Neil and Buzz walked on the moon. I thought we'd be on Mars by now, for sure, when I was a kid. You could be frustrated about it, or you could be kind of glad that you work somehow in making it happen eventually. I mean, like I said earlier, this is one of the hardest things we're ever going to do as a species. And, you can't be entirely frustrated by the fact that it didn't happen in your working career or in your lifetime if you've made a contribution to it happening eventually. And so, yeah, it may not happen, while I'm still working at NASA, but I like to think that I've made a contribution to it happening eventually. You know, great things sometimes involve multiple generations to get done.
We're coming up toward the end of our 90-minute program, so what should we have talked about that I've omitted or forgotten or didn't even know enough to ask you about, or what else would you like to say, or takeaways or pearls of wisdom for us?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me, and thanks for all the folks who called in and wrote in with great questions. There's a lot of smart people who obviously listen to this show and who understand. In terms of pearls of wisdom, you know, NASA has been looking at how we send humans to Mars for a long time, and we continue to do that. We always have some group of people massaging that plan and improving it, and that's still true today. And the great good lesson there is that it's Mars that informs generally what we do today. So when you hear about Gateway, when you hear about Orion, when you hear about SLS, some of these other programs that are going today, those don't exist in isolation. All of those have real connections to getting us to Mars eventually. And sometimes it looks like they're little detours, but we work really hard to try to make sure that there's hard connections between the things, those programs that we're doing today and getting to Mars tomorrow.
So I got one probably last question that just came in. Todd is a faithful listener in San Diego by email, and he said, many of us, especially listening to this show, are not supportive of SLS or Orion, largely because of the high cost, especially when compared, say, to Falcon Heavy and to futuristic SpaceX costs, although they haven't happened yet, but then neither has SLS. Do you foresee the commercial launchers, especially when Blue Origin gets into the game, taking over the launch market, even for NASA and the Humans to Mars program? Or will SLS still be essential despite its high cost and high operating and launch cost?
So I certainly see the rockets that companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin are building being huge players in human exploration in the future. Like I said earlier, NASA's current trajectory is that if there are commercial capabilities available, we're going to use them. Where something like SLS fits in is there's a segment of the launch market, the ultra-heavy launch market, that is not it's not a viable market for commercial companies. You know, if we said, hey, we want to launch 130 tons into low Earth orbit, there's no market for that for a SpaceX or for a Blue Origin or for anyone else. And that's where SLS really comes in. So I actually see that you need all of the above. You know, you let the Falcon Heavies and the BFRs do what they do. And what they can't do, that's where you need the government to step in and have its launch system.
Well, let's hope it flies and is gets closer to being affordable. I guess that's one thing to put on the wish list. Anything else you would like to add? And we certainly appreciate your being with us this Friday morning.
Well, thanks, David. Yeah, one last thing. The two callers ago talked about, do you get frustrated, you know, maybe working on this stuff and you don't see it quite coming true as fast as you want it. That actually reminded me of, I think it was a Greek proverb that said, a society grows great when old men plant trees in whose shade they know they shall never sit. And sometimes you just have to plant trees. And hopefully someone else will be able to take it from there and get us to Mars.
I sort of feel that way too, and I'm coming up on 20 years on the space show in a couple of years, and it is vastly different today than it was when I started the program and started my business school dissertation. but it's not where I would like to see it. And I would imagine a lot of this stuff is beyond my lifetime. But we've documented this path, and it has been a remarkable path. And I think a lot of people have gotten a lot of really good information and education from listening to people like you and space advocates and others that know what they're talking about. And it's made them a lot more knowledgeable and maybe helped some people go and develop space skills or robotic skills or something like that. I don't know if you've seen this HBO program. It's HBO at Home or something like that, but it's called Vice. Are you familiar with this at all?
I am not.
So they're Session 8, and it's I have Comcast, so it's on demand on my HBO program. I think it's called HBO at Home. It's a special HBO thing. Talked about SETI and the new tools coming on board for searching for ET. And so for those that think searching SETI ways is ridiculous, you're going to be really happy with what's about to come forth. But also the advance of 3D printing and manufacturing, and they talked about how it's changing the world of making space hardware. And the space hardware aspect and, you know, being able to go further and do more things with hardware and 3D printing and even printing rocket motors and other things was a big part of this VICE program. And we didn't talk about anything like that, but the tools being used to take us to Mars are developing really fast. And I'm assuming as an engineer you're more aware of all of this than I am as a non-engineer. But what's changing and making things so much more plausible today are the tools that we have to work with and how those very tools are evolving probably as we're talking. And I would recommend it if people have HBO and go find it. It's called Vice, and it's session number 8. It's a 30-minute session. And it's worth seeing, and it's directly applicable to what we've been talking about as to how we go to Mars, because I bet you, John, that the technology being used when we send humans to Mars in, say, 15 years is radically different than what we're doing today.
Well, yeah, that's one of the great things is technology keeps accelerating, and that makes these bold missions we're talking about more likely to happen.
Absolutely. So I would recommend that for listeners if you have access to it. John, I want to thank you very much for sharing your Friday morning and early afternoon with us and for the work that you're doing. And I hope we can check in with you and talk to you again down the road.
You bet. Thank you, David.
Thank you. And listeners, back on Sunday with Open Lines. So I want to thank John Connolly for being here, those of you who called and those of you who sent in emails. Everyone have a great weekend. And keep looking up. Goodbye from John David and The Space Show.